Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Environmental Law and Property Rights Practice Group, was recorded on Tuesday, February 12, 2013, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group telephone conference call. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion on today's call are those of our experts, and also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. Our expert today is Timothy Bishop, a partner at the Mayer Brown Law Firm, where he's an appellate litigator. He has briefed more than 60 cases in the Supreme Court, having argued five of those cases, perhaps six now, I don't know if the count's quite current. In the environmental law area, he's ranked as a top practitioner by Chambers, Best Lawyers in America, Euromoney's Best of the Best USA, and other publications. His full bio is available on our website, and it was provided to you in the notice of this call. We're going to begin with his opening remarks of about 20 minutes, a little bit longer than normal since we have just one speaker. After that, we'll spend the balance of our time on your questions and his answers. He did argue the case we're talking about today in early December, so we're very, very much looking forward to his insights. And with that, please go right ahead with your opening remarks.
Thanks, Dean. Good afternoon, everyone, and thanks very much for joining us. I appreciate your interest in the case, which is Georgia Pacific West against NEDC, NEDC being an Oregon-based environmental group. And this is a fairly complex case. There are a lot of different threads in this case, including one that I'll talk about, mootness, that was thrown into the mix on the business day before oral argument when EPA promulgated a new rule. But what the case is about is forest roads and how they are regulated under the Clean Water Act. As anyone who's flown over the country soon realizes, vast amounts of land are covered by forests. In fact, a third of the United States is forested. And those forests are crisscrossed by hundreds of thousands of miles of roads, roads that are complex in their ownership, federal, state, county ownership, a lot of private ownership as well. The control of the roads is often separated from the ownership, dealt with under contract so that the users maintain them. And they're used for a lot of different purposes, for forestry, obviously for fire control, for recreation, for habitat maintenance. And ever since the Clean Water Act was passed in 1972, EPA has said that those roads that are used for logging do not need to be permitted under the Clean Water Act. Now, there's no doubt that sediment runs off from those roads when it rains. When you have heavy rains or flooding, the surface of the road gets run into rivers and streams that are nearby. And often that occurs through ditches and culverts that run alongside and under those roads. And so the issue in the case is when you have sediment, which is a pollutant under the Clean Water Act, run off the road, end up in one of those ditches, and be carried by a ditch to a navigable water of the United States, how is that to be regulated? EPA's position since passage of the Clean Water Act has been that that sediment is best controlled through best management practices that are run on a local, state, and local level. Every state has either mandatory or voluntary best management practices. Best management practices that often, in fact, require the use of ditches and culverts to control sedimentation. And EPA's take on this has been that that is a sensible way to regulate the pollution that can be caused by forest roads, that it's a robust type of control and particularly important that it's control that is particularized to the geography and topography of the road in question, which varies enormously around the country and even within a single forest. The environmental plaintiffs in this case have another idea, and that is that these ditches and culverts are point sources under the Clean Water Act, and that as point sources, the owner or operator of those roads have to obtain for each discharge point an NPDES permit under Section 402 of the Clean Water Act. So that is what this case is about. Is EPA's system that's been in place since 1972 of state and local regulation through best management practices appropriate, or as NED says, are these point source discharges that require an NPDES permit under the Clean Water Act? EPA's approach has differed somewhat as the Clean Water Act has developed over the years. Initially, it looked at the very broad, potentially broad language of the point source definition in the statute, which talks about a point source being any discernible, confined, discrete conveyance of pollutants, including any ditch. It looked at that, and I think it was frankly horrified at the idea of the breadth of regulation that could be entailed, and not only the breadth, but also just regulation that doesn't make any sense. The idea that stormwater precipitation-driven runoff, whenever it ends up in a ditch, is required to be permitted under the NPDES. EPA would spend every dime that it gets in issuing those sorts of permits without improving the environment at all compared to the best management practices that have been in place. And the EPA's initial approach was to define certain types of conveyance as not being point sources. And in doing so, it relied on both the language of the definition and particularly the word discrete, and also on the fact that the point source regulation doesn't make any sense. Individualized permitting doesn't make any sense for these large rural areas where the stormwater is rain driven. And so it promulgated the silvicultural rule in 1973, revised in 76 and 1980, a rule that defines silvicultural or forestry-related point sources as four particular fairly narrow types of activity that all involve the active use of water by foresters, and then said that all other forestry activities are non-point source to be regulated by BMPs, not by the NPDES permitting system. It said specifically that runoff, precipitation-driven runoff, and runoff from the construction and maintenance of forest roads is non-point source. It regulated in that manner until the mid-1980s, but there was still litigation brought by environmental groups who believed that the language of the point source definition rendered that approach improper. And Congress in the mid-1980s completely changed the way that the Clean Water Act deals with stormwater to make the system one that more accurately reflects the environmental issues on the ground that are result from stormwater. The 1987 amendments to the Clean Water Act instituted a separate regime for point source stormwater. Delineating some types of stormwater discharges requiring a permit, and otherwise leaving it to EPA as to which would and would not require permitting. And the particular provision at issue in this case is that Congress stated that discharges, stormwater discharges through a point source that are associated with industrial activity do require a Clean Water Act permit. It didn't define those terms. EPA then defined those terms in regulations, and its regulations state that, referring back to the silviculture rule, that those discharges that do not require permits under the silviculture rule, including for forest roads, are not discharges associated with industrial activity, and so are also exempt from permitting under the stormwater regime. It was that sort of two-part regulatory regime that NEDC attacked in this case by bringing an enforcement action against Oregon as the permitting authority, and my clients, who are essentially forestry industry, paper products industry participants. NEDC said that we were violating the Clean Water Act by not having permits for the ditches that drained forest roads in Oregon. And that the Ninth Circuit agreed with NEDC. It held, first of all, that EPA did not have the authority under the plain language of the statute to delineate ditches alongside forest roads as being non-point source. And looking at the stormwater rule, it thought that these roads were plainly associated with industrial activity because they were used for carting logs and logging equipment. And looking at the EPA's regulations, it simply disagreed with EPA on what EPA's regulations meant. Whereas EPA had said that our regulations mean forest roads don't need permits, the Ninth Circuit, Judge Fletcher, looked at EPA's regulations and say, you're misreading your own regulations, EPA. You are requiring permits for these. That ruling was disastrous for the forestry industry and for the states and counties in which that industry occurs. As Senator Ron Wyden, a Democratic senator from Oregon, said, the Ninth Circuit decision would shut down forestry on private state and tribal lands. The U.S. Forest Service, which has 400,000 miles of roads through forests, immediately put out a bulletin saying that how adversely this ruling would affect all of the entities involved in resource management in the nation's forests, and how it anticipated a decade of trying to permit the 400,000 miles of its roads on U.S. forest land. So the costs involved in 402 permitting are enormous, and beyond the costs, the opportunity for litigation that the permitting process and then operation under permits provide to groups that simply don't like forestry activities is enormous, and the cost of that litigation and disruption of that litigation are enormous. So we petitioned for certiorari, and interestingly, the court called for the views of the Solicitor General. The reason it had to do that is that this suit was brought as an enforcement action, not as a challenge to a rule, because a rule challenge would be out of time here, given the decades that have passed since the silvicultural rule and the stormwater rule were passed. It was brought as an enforcement action, and EPA was not a party. EPA participated as an amicus below on the side of the industry, but it was not a party, so the Supreme Court called for the views of the Solicitor General. And the Solicitor General, while agreeing with us on the merits, urged the court not to grant certiorari in the case because it planned to address the issue by promulgating a new rule. And in fact, it issued a notice of intent the day before it filed its brief, saying that it planned to address the Ninth Circuit ruling by issuing a rule that clarified that the use of forest roads for logging activities was not associated with industrial activity, and therefore no permit was required. Now, despite that argument from the United States, the Supreme Court granted certiorari. This case was argued in December. The business day before I argued it, EPA in fact promulgated its final rule, and the final rule says that the only silvicultural point sources are the four that are identified in the silvicultural rule, that no other silvicultural activities, and that includes forest roads, are industrial activity, and therefore they don't require a permit under the Clean Water Act. The first question that I was asked by Chief Justice Roberts at oral argument was less in the form of a question than a statement, which was, congratulations, counsel, you've got everything that you want, which is not true, as I spent most of the argument explaining, because that rule obviously would be and now has been challenged by NEDC. That rule is essentially exactly the same as the rule that is in litigation here. It's a mere clarification of something that has actually been clear for decades. So what we now look at, if the court were to think this case moot, is another 5 years of litigating about an issue that the Ninth Circuit thinks it has already decided under a different but very similar regulatory regime. We urge the court at argument to decide this case. The United States urged it to find the case moot and not decide it on the merits. And leave the litigation to litigation about the new rule. The court did order additional briefing after arguments. All of the parties filed supplemental briefs addressing the mootness issue. One interesting thing, I'll just finish here, the third sort of strand of what is going on in this case is the question about where cases like this belong. Environmental group here filed this as an enforcement action in district court, saying that we were in violation of the statute by discharging sediment from these ditches without a Clean Water Act permit. It's our position in the litigation that what this really is a rule challenge. If the silviculture rule and if the stormwater rule are proper rules, then we win this case. So the only way that NEDC wins this case is if those rules are struck down. In our view, that's precisely what the Ninth Circuit panel did in this case. And because this case depends on whether those rules are appropriate or not under the statute, this has to be brought as a rule challenge, not as an enforcement action. Under Section 1369 of the Clean Water Act, a rule challenge may only be brought in the courts of appeals within 120 days of promulgation of the rule. So in our view, this suit was brought in the wrong court, out of time, and should have been dismissed as for want of jurisdiction. So that issue was argued in the court. It would also be an issue under the challenge to the new rule, where NEDC has said that it will proceed with enforcement action in district court, but has also filed a protective 1369B rule challenge in the Ninth Circuit. And so even before you get to the merits of this case in a challenge to the new rule, you're facing a substantial litigation question about where does the case belong to begin with. And so we have urged the court to simply decide this case on the merits and cut through all of that, cut through years of uncertainty and cost, and affirm the position that EPA has taken for the last 36 years, which is that these ditches are appropriately regulated by the states under BMPs, and that there's really no improvement in the environmental situation by imposing an end of pipe Clean Water Act permitting regime on what is, after all, precipitation. There's a lot more I could say about this case, but let me leave it there and open it up to questions. Dean?
Yes, thank you very much, Mr. Bishop. We certainly appreciate your remarks. Let's open the floor to questions. In a moment, everyone should hear a prompt that will say the floor mode is on. After that, if you have a question for Mr. Bishop, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question for our expert, Timothy Bishop, who argued this case in the Supreme Court, please push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. And while we're waiting to see if there are questions from the audience, let me make a quick, brief programming note that concern telephone conference calls in the near future. On Thursday, we're going to be discussing another environmental case, this one a dispute between the city of Tombstone, Arizona, and the National Parks System, as the city has unsuccessfully tried to get access to water lines, water supply lines that supply the city with its water that happened to cross national parks. They want to repair those damaged lines and haven't been able to do so far. That's Thursday, 12 noon Eastern time. And then on Friday at 1 p.m., we'll be discussing the Bronx Household case, which is a Second Circuit case involving the after-hours use of school facilities, which many people thought was settled law, but continues, I think. This case centers around the definition of worship and the use of those facilities for worship, quote-unquote, in non-school hours. Again, if you have a question for our expert today, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Our lines are open. And while we wait to see if someone rings in with a question, let me ask you, Tim, what is the record of the EPA in cases like this in the Supreme Court?
Pretty awful. You know, we've seen that both in substantive and procedural cases, particularly under the Clean Water Act, for many years now. You do get the sense that the EPA is one of the least trusted agencies among the justices these days. You know, just in my own experience, the first Clean Water Act case that I argued in the court, EPA had claimed that it could regulate any puddle or ditch anywhere in the country if it could show that a migratory bird had landed on it under the Clean Water Act. Puddle doesn't have to be a navigable water. The EPA's idea was that it could regulate water up to the extent of the Commerce Clause, and that because migratory birds are hunted by folks who spend money on ammunition and guns, that they were sufficiently connected to commerce that when they then landed on a puddle, it brought their puddle within the regulation of the Clean Water Act. And five members of the court thought that that was appropriately thought that that was a ridiculous position and a vast expansion of EPA's power, jurisdictional power over waters of the United States. You know, subsequently, the whole series of Clean Water Act cases where EPA has lost or has been criticized along the way. I argue the water transfer case in the court, where the question is whether you need a 402 permit for waters that are transferred from one water body to another. In that particular case, the Miccosukee case, it was through pumps from one side of a ditch to another dike in the Everglades. EPA had never required permits in that case. Appropriately, we thought we were aligned with EPA in the case. But the in vacating an 11th Circuit decision that held that we did need permits, the court was very critical of the fact that EPA had not adopted a regulation in that case, and subsequently it did. So you see, you know, in the court's criticisms of EPA, you see both a substantive dissonance with the way that EPA reads its statutes. But even when it's aligned with us and is taking a more reasonable approach to regulation, the court is often critical of the procedures that EPA has used to get where it is. So it's hard really to find an area where the court and EPA see eye to eye. And I think what you see as a result of that, and what you saw in this case with the government CBSG brief, is EPA does everything it can to stay out of this court. Its view is, these are our statutes. We're going to interpret them, and we don't want interference from the court. And when the court does get involved, we tend to lose, and we'd rather not be there.
Is EPA, let me ask you this question, is EPA losing these cases 5-4 or 6-3, 7-2, or is it narrowly decided, or is there pretty much unanimity in the court?
No, these are fairly, I don't want to say always, but particularly on substance, where you get to an issue of whether EPA has properly interpreted the scope of its powers under the Clean Water Act, the court tends to be divided 5-4. The liberals think that if EPA wants to regulate something, go ahead and do it. You know, if EPA has decided it would be good for the environment to regulate every puddle, then the liberals are inclined to find authority under the statute. The conservatives are not. I think when you turn to the procedural side, you see a lot more. Miccosukee was an 8-1 decision. On the procedural side, there's much more, I think, unanimity in thinking that EPA is one of those agencies that doesn't really cross its T's and dot its I's as well as it needs to.
Mm-hmm. Once again, in our audience, if you have a question, our lines are open. If you have a question for Mr. Bishop, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Let me ask you again while we're waiting for audience members. It seems to me an extraordinary thing for an agency to promulgate a rule on the eve of a Supreme Court case in particular that would have the effect of mooting, or they would argue would have the effect of mooting that case. Is that an extraordinary thing? How often does it happen? And how was that, I mean, did they notice, did they give notice to the court? How was that received by the court? Can you say more about that? And then I do see on my screen we've got a couple audience questions. So.
Yeah, well, just quickly on that, Malcolm Stewart, the Deputy Solicitor General who argued this for the government, we ceded them 10 minutes of time, spent most of his argument defending the agency's decision to promulgate this rule the business day before argument and not to have given the court prior notice that it was coming. And I feel some sympathy to him towards him for that, because the fact is that at the cert stage, the government's principal argument to the court about why it should not take the case was that they intended to promulgate this rule. So I don't think the court can say that it wasn't on notice. Our supplemental brief at the cert stage explained why, even if this rule came, the court should grant and decide the case anyway. So, there's never been any question that a rule was in the offing. It was really just a question of the timing. But the court clearly was annoyed with the government for sandbagging it with a final rule the day before argument, and annoyed with the Solicitor General for not having told it, when the case, for example, when the rule went to OMB 3 or 4 weeks before, that had happened. And you know, I think it just shows the lengths to which the agency will go to try to stay away from the Supreme Court. And if you look at the timing here, they promulgated a notice of intent the day before they filed their CVSG brief telling the court not to take this case. They finalized the rule the day before argument, clearly with the understanding that would enable the SG to argue the case was moot and should not be decided. You know, even though they are with us, the petitioner, on the merits, and even though I would think, we certainly think, that we have a winning case here, that there's no doubt that the Ninth Circuit seriously erred under the law, and that the consequences of that error would are of great practical importance, warranting a Supreme Court decision. So, you know, to us, it's mysterious as to why in this particular case, where I think the arguments are very strong, why the agency just doesn't want to be there, even in a case like this. But I think when you talk to folks at EPA in these cases, it's very clear. They really make no bones about it that they don't trust the Supreme Court, and they want to avoid decisions as much as possible.
Interesting. Now, we do have three questions now, but let me ask you a follow-up question. You mentioned the coincidence in time of the intent, notice of intent, and then the final rule. Were those done very quickly?
Yes.
Within the sense of how EPA promulgates other rules, that is, from
yes.
beginning to end.
Yes, and if you look at the average length of time that it takes for a rule to come out of OMB, this was considerably foreshortened. You know, certainly we've seen this was a relatively simple EPA rule change, and so, you know, it would not have taken the same length as a complex Clean Air Act rule, but I don't think anyone looking at this would say this was the normal course of business at EPA.
Fascinating. Well, we do have three questions now from our audience. Before we go to the first question, again, if you have a question, if you want to get in the queue, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Let's go to our first caller.
Hi, this is Brian Barner with Hunton and Williams in San Francisco. And I'd like to ask you about the issue of deference to EPA. In light of recent cases like Christopher v. Smith Klein Beecham and Chase Bank, the Supreme Court seems to be questioning how much deference it should provide under Auer and Seminole Rock, especially in cases of enforcement where you have large potential penalties and there's a change in the enforcement position from what was previously done for decades, like there was here. How do you see those cases as playing into this case, if at all? Thank you.
Right. Well, I think, you know, clearly the conservatives are concerned about Auer. Their Justice Scalia, despite having written Auer, has the case that sort of is usually cited along with Seminole for the proposition that the courts will defer to an agency's interpretation of its own regulations. I think everyone on the conservative side of the court, I think, has moved towards Justice Scalia's position there for good reason. The trouble with deference to agency regulation is that it encourages a situation where the agency promulgates an unclear, ambiguous rule, and then interprets it at its own convenience as it goes along, the result of which is that you fail to give notice to the regulated community as to what the rules are. And deferring to the agency's interpretation of its own ambiguous regulation is extremely dangerous from that perspective. And I think Christopher shows the court beginning, not finishing, I'm sure, but beginning to put limits on that. So obviously we were concerned about that here, and the stormwater rule is there are degrees of ambiguity in the stormwater rule. There's no doubt about how EPA has interpreted it, though. And our principal argument here was not to say don't worry about these problems that our identified, but look at the specifics of this case. This is not a case like Christopher. What we have here is the paradigm of a situation where you should defer to EPA's interpretation of its own rule. The rule was promulgated in 1987. It was contemporaneously explained by EPA not to apply to, not to require permitting of forest roads. EPA has not wavered from its position in 1987 that forest roads used by loggers are not associated with industrial activity. And so it doesn't raise the notice problem that our deference has been recognized, that's been recognized to be problematic under our deference. And we argued that in our brief, and we also made sure that we had a law professor's brief that was addressed really solely to that question, a group of law professors who share the conservative justices' disquiet about our deference, who explain that this case just does not implicate the problems with that sort of deference. So, you know, I think what we urge the court to do, and I think the way the court is going, I think you see it in Christopher, is not towards abandoning our deference, but to marking cases based on the particulars of whether that deference is appropriate, or whether deferring in a particular situation would raise serious notice problems, in which case they won't defer, as in Christopher. So I do see them getting fairly granular in the way they approach that sort of deference.
All right, a couple more questions from our audience. Let's go to the next caller.
Hello, this is Bob Davis in Maine. It's interesting that the EPA is not a party to the case, but my question involves standing. On what basis does the environmental group have standing? Can standing be curtailed, and ought it to be curtailed?
Well, you certainly won't get any dispute from me that it ought to be curtailed. But the fact is that standing in environmental cases has become so routine at this point that the environmental groups trot out members with affidavits saying that they use the particular river in question, that they've seen the pollution, that they're upset by it, that they fish in those rivers, and they believe that the salmon in those rivers are not spawning properly because of the sediment in there. It just, you know, despite the promise of some of the Supreme Court standing cases, you know, a decade and more ago, my perception litigating this area is that defendants have largely given up on serious objections to standing. When you have an established environmental group with a lot of diverse members, you know, if Earth Justice or Sierra Club or a group like NEDC comes in, they are not going to have any trouble coming up with the requisite affidavits showing concrete harm to their members from the alleged pollution in the case. You know, what that means, of course, is that there's really standing is not a barrier to any, given the sorts of environmental groups that we have and that are active litigating. They can bring any case they want anywhere in the country. There's just not really a significant impediment to them doing that. And that's why I think, too, that the practicalities of permitting, whether permitting is required, go far beyond just applying for that permit and getting it, which is costly in itself. Because once you're in a permitting situation, then the environmental groups can dispute the terms of the permit. the issuance of the permit in the first place. And once the permit is in place, there are folks wandering around making sure that you're complying with it. And any sort of deviation from these permit terms, temporary or any glancing deviation, can be the subject of more litigation from these groups. So it's a problem.
So no matter how remote the interest, they would gain standing in from what you're saying.
Well, it's remoteness is in the eye of the beholder here. I think the court requires concrete harm, but they accept as concrete harm an affidavit from a member of a plaintiff organization that says, I use that, in this case, river, and I fish there, I canoe on it, and I think I'm being harmed by this pollution in this natural asset that I use. That's enough.
So is that standing granted by statute, or is it court granted?
That's court. That's really derives from the Supreme Court's standing precedents.
Thank you.
Looks like we have one more question, and then our lines will be open. Let's go to what for now looks to be our final question. If you have a question, again, push star and then pound on your telephone.
John Rowland, Constitution.org. It may be convenient for the court to defer to the findings of administrative agency. However, that seems to be in conflict with the due process principle that the burden of proof must lie on the prosecutor. And while a finding may be evidence of something, it is really only evidence of the operations of the administrator and not of the underlying background situation. Perhaps you could respond to how this line of argument might be used in your cases.
Well, I don't think there's no doubt. I think that deference is a two-edged sword. I happen for the last decade or so to have been litigating in areas where we are aligned with EPA, and surprisingly so to my mind, but. There is at EPA a recognition that they cannot permit everything, that it's simply not possible within budgetary constraints to do so, and that as an environmental matter, it doesn't make a lot of sense. And the two issues I've been particularly active litigating are the water transfer rule, where EPA, against an onslaught from the environmental groups, EPA, to its credit, has said that when you move water around within the nation's rivers and lakes, when you move it around, even though it contains pollutants, when you move it from one water body to another through a pipe or a ditch or a pump, that's not an introduction, an addition of pollutants to the navigable waters, and therefore doesn't require a permit. And again, in the Forest Road area, where it's basically recognized that states are much better positioned to regulate pollution resulting from dispersed forestry activities in the nation's forest than is EPA. So, so in my litigation, we tend to agree with the EPA at the moment and think that. It's gotten those issues correct. At the same time, I've litigated plenty of cases during my career where we think that EPA has gotten things entirely wrong, and that deference isn't required. So, my view is that rather than some due process principle about the agency's powers is that the Supreme Court has it right that you look at the statute, you see if what the agency has done is a reasonable read of what Congress said in the statute that it should do, If the agency promulgates a regulation, the court should take a hard look at that regulation and make sure that it really fits with the congressional goal, agencies should not be able to promulgate vague regulations and then apply them in enforcement proceedings as it goes along, where a rule did not in the first place give adequate notice of what conduct was required of the regulated community. I think the court is in its post-hour cases is moving along in those lines, as I've said. So, I think the Chevron, our Skidmore scheme of oversight of agency action actually works pretty well and allows courts to distinguish between good regulation and bad regulation. And in a more fruitful way than talk about due process. Now, I should say that it's an interesting question. I have a case I'm involved in at the moment where the question is where an agency is a litigant in the case, where it's got a vague rule and it promulgates. Its promulgation of what that rule means, its interpretation of what that rule means, takes place in the course of this litigation where it is a party. Can you take that interpretation seriously? And I think that really does raise a lot of due process issues. This particular case is a tax case where the IRS briefs in the case where it's seeking a lot of money purported to interpret a vague regulation in a way that will line its coffers while harming the taxpayer. So I think that's the sort of situation where you do really have to wonder, well, what is the due process rationale for deferring to an agency that promulgates a vague regulation and then says what it means in the course of litigation where it's trying to obtain a lot of money for itself. So, what I would say is it's contextual and that there's room for a lot of different approaches depending on the particular context of the agency action.
However, you're just making a policy argument. You haven't really addressed the problem of whether it is ever appropriate under any circumstance to defer to any administrative finding. I would argue that it is not.
Well, that's certainly a position. It's not the world in which I litigate these cases because there's a long body of Supreme Court precedent here that does allow for deference in certain situations. But I hear you.
Very good. Well, Mr. Bishop, it seems we've exhausted the questions from the audience, or you have, I should say. We do have a couple minutes left. Let me give you a minute or two, if you'd like, to express any final thoughts or wrap up, and in there, give you a chance to make a prediction if you're inclined to do that. I think a lot of litigators are reluctant to do that, but certainly welcome to do that if you want to do that.
Yeah, well, I would like to do that because the court here at argument, this is an eight-person court. Justice Breyer's brother sat by designation on the Ninth Circuit panel, so he recused himself and did not sit. It was an eight-person court, and they were clearly perplexed at oral argument about what to do with the case. They had granted it on these merits issues, and now EPA had thrown the spanner in the works with this late rule, and I think they were perplexed about how they should handle the case. It's clear from the fact that they granted, knowing that a rule was in the offing, that they thought that the practical consequences to the forestry industry of requiring permitting in a situation like this would be disastrous. 32 states filed an amicus brief on the side of the forestry industry saying this is a very important issue to us. We believe that we are the best regulators here, that we have the on-the-ground experience as to how to deal with the sorts of runoff that you get from forest roads and are much better situated to handle this than EPA. We had about 15 amicus briefs on our side from a very wide variety of of interest. So the court, you know, recognizes that these are important issues. I think they also recognize that the Ninth Circuit here overstepped its bounds. That for the Ninth Circuit to come in after 35 years of consistent agency interpretation of the Clean Water Act, absolutely consistent agency position, that this regulation should be left to the states and wasn't appropriate for the federal government. Incidentally, that's a position that comports completely with the language of the Clean Water Act itself. In the preamble to the Clean Water Act, Congress said that one of its principal goals in the statute was to preserve and protect the primary rights of the states to regulate pollution and to regulate land use. So in a situation like this, a very traditional state land use over forests, like over agriculture, sort of rural land use control, is quintessentially for the states and not for the federal government, and EPA's interpretation and the state's position in their amicus briefs comported with that very well. So I think the court had plenty in front of it to persuade it of the importance of the issue and to persuade them that the Ninth Circuit has this wrong when it looks at what EPA has done and reads it differently from the way that EPA has read it, not just for this litigation, not just for a few months, but the way that EPA has read the statute and read its own rules ever since 1973. So I think on the merits, you know, things are teed up, and then you have a situation where EPA throws in a regulation at the last second, not a regulation that doesn't change the law, but that says basically, look, courts, we're just confirming what we've been saying for the last 35 years here. Here's a reg with some different language, and now court go away. I think that there will be at least some justices, the justices are reluctant to reach out and take jurisdiction where they think that it's inappropriate, where there are vehicle problems. But I do think this is a case where the practicalities, as we have argued, that the practicalities, which are that the court can decide the issues here, which would largely end and be preclusive of future litigation about the new rule. If it decides this case, decides the merits issues that we have presented in this case, any DC will have no viable arguments that the new rule is impermissible under the statute or otherwise improper. And so the court can either decide the case or it can say it's moot and vacate the Ninth Circuit decision and allow any DC to keep litigating this, which benefits absolutely no one. I think this is a decent test for the court. Should courts get mired in the technicalities of doctrines like mootness, or should they look at the context, a case that's fully briefed before the court, where with 30 amicus briefs between the two sides, there's no doubt that millions of dollars have been spent in litigating this. It's been in litigation now since 2005, this particular case. Do you decide these issues and end it now while it's teed up, or do you rely on a technicality of the mootness doctrine to say, no, go away and keep doing this for another 5 or 6 years, and then we'll see you back here? So I do think it's a very interesting test of the extent to which the court will approach this practically in a way that actually assists the litigants, or whether they'll rely on a mootness doctrine to say, no, keep spending money and let's keep up the uncertainty. So I'm hopeful here that that they'll come out and decide this on the merits and decide it our way.
Well, terrific. Mr. Bishop, Timothy Bishop, thank you so much for joining us today and for sharing your thoughts. We certainly appreciate that. Maybe we can have you back when the case is decided. We'd be happy to do that if you're available. To our audience, thank you for your questions and your engagement today. Please join us for our next Teleforum conference call on Thursday, when we'll be discussing Tombstone water rights. And for a schedule of complete schedule of calls, check our website. But until Thursday, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.